John chapter 4. John 4. We're looking at the woman at the well, unnamed person, that John introduces, giving testimony as to who Christ is. And you can easily understand why in John chapter 4, the incident with the woman at the well is brought into the picture, because when you come down to chapter 4 and verse 25, you have the following testimony. Having had a discussion and conversation with Christ, the woman said to him, "I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When that one comes, he will declare all things to us." Jesus said to her, "I who speak to you am he." And since John wants to prove to us that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, how could he possibly leave out the incident in John chapter 4 where in very clear words, the woman talks about the coming Messiah, and Jesus across the board says, "I am he." That's the value and the chief value of this particular incident. Now, in getting into the woman at the well, we begin with a historical transition. We begin with the historical transition from where Jesus had been to where Jesus is going to be, and that's in chapter 4, verses 1 through 6. Very simply, we'll break into two parts, the historical transition in the first six verses, then the conversation down through verse 26. The transition involves two things. Number one, historically, Jesus is going to transition from Judea to Samaria. And that gives us our two points, transition from Judea, verses 1 through 3. Chapter 4. When, therefore, the Lord knew that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself was not baptizing, but his disciples were, he left Judea and departed again into Galilee. Notice the emphasis. He is going to abandon Galilee. Well, the first word that we need to tie in is coming in verse 1, when, therefore. What does the therefore point to? The therefore, beginning chapter 4, takes us back to 3:22. And if you drop back to 3:22, you have the following words. After these things, Jesus and his disciples came into the land of Judea, and there he was spending time with them and baptizing. Chapter 4, verse 1. When therefore Jesus knew that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John. So the therefore points back to the activity in Judea. And it is because of the activity in Judea in terms of teaching, in terms of baptizing, that in chapter 4, verse 1, the Lord leaves there because the Pharisees had heard. There's an interesting note in John. Whenever John talks about the Jewish people, not one single time does John ever refer to the Sadducees. He always refers to the Pharisees. And that is because the Pharisees were the true representative class of unbelieving Israel. They were the true representative class of unbelieving Jews. And therefore, John, while he may have had them in mind at times, you will not find the word Sadducee in the book of John at all. He does not refer to the Herodians. Whenever John refers to the nation of Israel, to the Jewish people, in terms of belief and unbelief, and basically John is going to show us how belief and unbelief parallels its development throughout the book. The Pharisees, as far as here are concerned, is the representative class as far as the nation is concerned. Now, in verse 1, when the Pharisees knew that Jesus was making more disciples, the Lord left Judea and went to Samaria. Why did he leave? In other words, why did the Pharisaic knowledge of what Jesus was doing cause him to move? Or, we'll put it in form of a question, why did Jesus leave Judea? And the answer that we find many times throughout the Gospels is this: to prevent premature confrontation. He wanted to prevent premature confrontation. Now, when we see that point, and Jesus did that on many occasions, he would leave a certain region because the Jews were trying to kill him. His actions in terms of avoiding premature conversation carries with it a very important lesson. It shows the relationship of God's sovereignty in caring for him to human responsibility. We developed that a little bit last time, but let's put down the two things that are connected with it. And these are simply two factors that exist during the life of Christ that help us to put in a harmonious relationship God's sovereignty and human relationship. For example, we know beyond any question that he, Jesus, was sovereignly protected for his hour. The Gospel of John talks about, and Jesus talks about, his hour, or in many cases he talks about his time. And by his hour and by his time, we will find out as we get to the end of the Gospel of John, refers to the hour of his death, the time of his crucifixion. And he is very careful not to get down to Jerusalem and have a premature confrontation when he would be taken before his hour. And since he is protected for his hour, and let's note two passages that deal with that, John 7 and John 8, these two passages show unusual statements that indicate that throughout his life, in a very sovereign way, he was protected. In verse 30, they, that would refer to the Jewish officials, primarily Pharisees, were seeking therefore to seize him. And no man laid his hand on him, because his hour was not yet come. And the emphasis that becomes obvious at that point is he is being sovereignly protected for that hour. And here he is in Jerusalem. They want to arrest him. They already have decided to put him to death, but God is saying it is not the time. The hour is not here. And therefore, in some sovereign way, God protects him. How did God do that in verse 30? I don't know. The text doesn't tell us, does it? It simply says it was not his time. It was not his hour, and nobody could lay a hand on him in some sovereign way. Chapter 8 has the same concept. Two passages, 7:20 and 8:30 has the same idea. Or 8:20, I'm sorry. 7:30, 8:20. Right here. 8:20, it's another case where in a mysterious manner, we do not know how, but in a mysterious manner he was protected. He is in Jerusalem. He's near the temple. And verse 20 says, these words he spoke in the treasury. As he taught in the temple, no one seized him because his hour had not yet come. And how did God do that? Did he erected some kind of shield between him and his enemies so they could not touch him? Now, we said that the way Jesus acted in relationship to this truth is a beautiful example of the relationship of God's sovereignty, as we saw in those two verses, to human responsibility. So he was sovereignly protected for his hour. At the same time, he exercised care to avoid premature confrontation. He exercised care to see that the hour did not come before its time. In the minds of men, the sovereignty of God and the responsibility of man, you will never reconcile. What you must do is come to the lines of teaching in Scripture and see that it recognizes sovereign protection. Things will not happen before God's hour, and you do your best to see that they don't happen before His hour. And I realize that from human logic standpoint, you say, well, if He can't be touched before His hour, He can't be touched before His hour. That is correct. But that does not justify a further step of saying, therefore, He does not need to exercise care. He can walk through the temple. He can walk on the altar. He can do anything He wishes. He will never be taken before His hour. And the mix there is the mix of He cannot be taken before His hour, which is true. The false part of that is He can do anything He pleases. And the same is true to us. This would apply in many areas. If God is in sovereign control of what happens, there is no need to pray. Because if God has said, this is the way it's going to be, this is the way it will be, and you can pray and pray and pray and nothing will change it. That's false logic. It may seem true from the human standpoint. Jesus did not operate that way. We should not operate that way. God is sovereign in His plan. That does not eliminate prayer. That does not eliminate the need to ask God to make things go in this direction, because very often His sovereign direction is hidden. It's often secret. In this case, it is not. But the lesson involved is the sovereignty of God does not mean do not exercise the use of means. And if you'll stick with chapter 7, you can see He's working in such a way to see that He exercises care that these things do not happen prematurely. Chapter 7, for example, in verse 1. After these things, Jesus was walking in Galilee, for He was unwilling to walk in Judea. Why? God will take care of you. Shouldn't be afraid to be in Judea. Well, that was not the reasoning. He was unwilling to walk in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill Him. The use of means never contradicts sovereignty. And we will stop with that statement. The use of means does not contradict sovereignty. The use of means does not contradict sovereignty. And we can apply that in many, many areas. As a believer, you cannot be taken before your time, but if the doctor has prescribed medication to keep you here, trust God's plan and take your pills. God will protect you as you drive your car, and we can certainly assert that that is true. Be sure to carry plenty of insurance, and certainly liability as the law requires. And that is simply saying the use of means, my car insurance, does not contradict the sovereignty of God in caring for me. Could we say if someone comes out of an intersection, slams into the front of your car today, that that was under the sovereign control of God? Yes, we can. That does not mean, however, that you should therefore drive with abandon and not come to an intersection. And when you come to the intersection, always expect that the other car is not going to see the stop sign. What do they call it? Defensive driving. Always assume the car is coming through. And at the same time, we trust the sovereignty of God. And that is very, very important, because many, many Christians take a wrong turn in the road at that point, see a contradiction here, and go to seed in one other direction. Either do not believe that God is sovereign at all and you worry yourself into a bleeding ulcer by the exercise of means, or on the other hand, believe that God is sovereign and you make no provision and carry no insurance, which doesn't hurt you, but it sure does hurt the other person because you were doctrinally messed up. Okay, Jesus then is going to leave Judea in light of the fact that His life is being sought, and the Pharisees are going to become jealous. He recognizes that, and so he moves out. Okay, notice also in chapter 4, as he departs, and we're now going to move from Judea, and now from Judea to Samaria. From Judea and now to Samaria. verses 4 through 6. Verse 4, he had to pass through Samaria. And the first thing we will want to note is, why did he have to pass through Samaria? And what makes it a necessity? And when it says he had to, does that express absolute necessity? We will find out it does not. He had to pass through Samaria, so he came to a city of Samaria called Sychar, near the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Joseph's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied from his journey, was sitting thus by the well. Let's stop for a moment and note that Jesus was wearied. And that introduces a whole class of statements that we need to understand. And that is this. Jesus was the God-man. Therefore, some statements, or sometimes, only his humanity is in view. Sometimes, only humanity is in view. And sometimes only deity is in view when he is described. Obviously, at this point, when it says he is wearied, only humanity is in view. There are other times when only his deity is in view. And that is important to note. The reason we can make those two statements is what? The Word, deity, became flesh, humanity, and dwelt among us. And therefore, if you want to look at Jesus and note that as far as his human body was concerned, he was tired. That does not diminish his deity. It's only looking at that part of his particular being. We need to remember that apart from sin, whatever you can say about your humanity, we can say about his. I repeat the statement. Apart from sin, we can say about his humanity anything that can be said about ours. We tire. We get thirsty. We get hungry. None of those things, being tired or thirsty or hungry, are sin. And therefore, since they're simply part of the human condition. And if they're part of our human condition, they're also part of his. That includes all the limitations of humanity. And obviously, being thirsty is a limitation. We can't go forever without water. Being tired is a limitation. We have to have rest. Being hungry is a limitation. He had all of those things apart from sin, and therefore that's a way that we ought to very closely identify with him, is that he identifies with our human condition in every way. However, if you go back to chapter 2 and look at the ending verses of that chapter, you have a viewpoint that looks at him from the standpoint of his deity, and it says something that cannot be said of our humanity. Verse 24, Jesus on his part was not entrusting himself to them, for he knew all men. You can't say that of humanity. That's omniscience. And because he did not need anyone to bear witness concerning man, he needed no information. It was all innate. He needed no one to bear witness concerning man, for he himself knew what was in man. And therefore, we're looking at John 4, and we have no contradiction. This is not evidence that Jesus was not the God-man. It simply looks at him from the standpoint of his humanity. Okay, second, out of verses 4 through 6, we need to say that in verse 4, the necessity to go through Samaria was not absolute. In other words, it was not a geographical necessity. Now, granted, Samaria lay between Judea and Samaria. And if you want to go in a straight line, there's no way to go from Judea to Galilee without passing through Samaria. However, if you were an Orthodox Jew and you were down here in Judea And up here is Galilee, and here is Samaria, and here is Judea at the bottom. And over here is your Dead Sea and the Jordan. If you were an Orthodox Jew, you hated Samaritans so bad that you would not dirty your feet with their land. If you were an Orthodox Jew, you would make a long trip out of a fairly short trip. And the way you would do it would be you would swing from Judea over the Jordan River to the east, up the eastern part of the eastern side of the Jordan River, and then you would swing back into Galilee and therefore never go into Samaria. It was longer, it was a more difficult trip, but nonetheless, for a strict Jew, it was the only way to go because Jews had no dealings with Samaritans, and you simply did not walk through their land in the interest of your Orthodox Judaism. It's interesting that Jesus does not choose to do that. So notice, geographically, he didn't have to go through Samaria. So the necessity is not geographical. The necessity, however, is spiritual. Not a geographical necessity, but rather a spiritual necessity. And the spiritual necessity is simply tied up with the nature of Jesus' mission. Jesus came, and we've already had John 3:16, he loved the world, and therefore it would not be appropriate for one who was going to give his life for the world to say, I can't go through Samaria, because Samaria is part of the world which he loved, and therefore from the spiritual standpoint, due to the nature of his ministry, he is going to go through Samaria, and we will see him doing so in this particular context. Remember, behind every move of Jesus was a divine imperative. Behind every move that he made, there was always divine imperative. He was sent by his Father, and divine imperative lay behind everything that he did. Let's run that quickly through John chapter 3, verse 14. Just read enough of them for you to get the flavor that Jesus always moved under divine imperative. He will say later on, I have done the will of him that sent me. And his consciousness of doing that will is reiterated many times. 3:14. And as Jesus lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must. And the must verb expresses the divine imperative behind the words here, the Son of Man be lifted up. The cross was an absolute divine imperative. Might be interesting to take Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, by the way, and trace out for yourself what are the divine imperatives that lay behind the ministry of Jesus. One of them is right here, and it was his death. Chapter 9, verse 4. All of the divine imperatives are significant. We're not stopping to develop that. In chapter 9, verse 4, you have a very general verse, and the general verse is simply throwing a blanket over everything that he does and says, everything I do is due to divine imperative. We must work the works of him who sent me. In other words, he conceived of himself as being sent by the Father. There were a set of works that he was to do, and those works were divine imperative. Why did he heal Lazarus? He had to. Raise Lazarus. Because it was divine imperative. Why did he turn water to wine at the marriage feast of Cana? Divine imperative. He had to. He always acted under the will and the impulse of his Father. Chapter 10, verse 16. I have other sheep which are not of this fold. I must bring them also. The bringing in of the Gentiles along with the Jews was divine imperative. That was his mission, to love, to die for, to save men, all men who will believe. 12:34. At this point, there is confusion over the divine imperative of the cross. And what they could not put together is that the Messiah, according to the Old Testament, will live forever. How can you be the Messiah and talk about dying? Well, 12:34, the multitude therefore answered him, We have heard out of the law that the Messiah is to remain forever. And how can you say the Son of Man must be lifted up? How do you explain the imperative that you may must be lifted up? Well, the answer to that is found in 20 and verse 9. Because the divine imperative that is connected with and follows his necessity to die is the divine imperative that says he must also rise. Chapter 20 and verse 9. For as yet they did not understand the Scripture that he must rise again from the dead. And so the answer to their question, the Messiah is to live forever, how can you say you must die? The answer to that is the next imperative. And that imperative is, if I die, I will be raised from the dead. The resurrection answers it. All right, back now to John 4. And before we leave the introductory section that talks about his departure from Judea and into Samaria, we need to make a concluding observation. And the observation is simply this. Jesus grants two interviews in John 3 and 4. And in chapter 3, you have the interview with Nicodemus. And it's a lengthy interview. In chapter 4, we have an interview with the woman of Samaria. And if you look at each one of those narratives, I cannot think of anywhere where a personal interview is granted that is any longer than the one given to Nicodemus, or any longer than the one given to the woman at the well. And yet at the same time, I cannot think of two people who would have less in common and who would be at odds with one another more than these two. Nicodemus was a prominent, remember he is the teacher, he is a prominent Orthodox Jew. Orthodox to the core. The woman at the well represented the class of people that was most hated by the Orthodox view, a Jew. She was most hated by the Orthodox Jew. And John, in his arrangement, has put those two interviews side by side. And I think the answer to why he has done this is that we have had that crucial verse in which we spent, what, three or even four times, John 3:16, "For God so loved the world." And that included the Orthodox Jew, but in going to those that were hated by the Orthodox Jew, you have an illustration of the fact that he loved the world. And thus, emphasis here is he is going to establish in what he does, it establishes the truth of John 3:16. And since part of that world excluded by the Orthodox Jew, but included by Jesus, was this woman that he sees at the well. All right, we started out then with John chapter 4. And we have now done the transition. Moved him out of Judea. He is now up into Samaria. And our next point to pick up with then is the conversation. The transition, and now the conversation. And the conversation extends from chapter 4 and verse 7 down through verse 26. The only thing we need to add by way of the setting is that as Jesus sits there by the well, the disciples are also there, but they've gone into the city in order to buy some food. And while they are gone, the conversation ensues. Notice chapter 4, verse 8 gives us that setting. The disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. So the Lord is now alone with the woman. And you go down and have the conversation that extends down through verse 26. And verse 26 is very climactic. because it's the part where he says, I am the Messiah. And notice with verse 27, it says, and at this point, his disciples came, and they marveled that he had been speaking with a woman, yet no one said, what do you seek, or why do you speak with her? And the intervening part is going to be powerful testimony as to the Messiahship of Jesus. The woman will manifest one characteristic, and the characteristic that comes through all of the time is she loves to avoid the real issues. The Lord will ask her something and begin to drive at a point, and she'll say, it's a nice day, isn't it? And he will say, call your husband. And she will say, where should you worship? She will be doing this at every point. She will be avoiding facing the issues. This will be the major characteristic of the woman. We'll pick up with her there tonight. Father, we're thankful for your word and your truth in Christ's name.